Faced with sickle cell anemia, the solution is in our blood. It's a matter of genetics. The more people from the Black communities who give blood, the better our chances to find compatible donors to help those affected by this disease. Faced with sickle cell anemia, we can't leave anyone behind. We have to donate. So don't wait. Book an appointment today at hemequebec.qc.ca because giving is in our blood.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
We're here to talk about this groundbreaking report that Amnesty's published in the last few days, a report that's made a lot of noise. For the right reasons, of course, even though you've been attacked also, but this was planned and expected. The report is 280 pages. So for people that haven't read it yet, there's obviously an executive summary that it's much shorter. But it, so 280 pages means you go very deep into the analysis, right? It's not like a PR, a press release or anything. It's a very detailed report. But I was wondering if you had like a couple of minutes to explain to someone what's the report about. And, you know, if you want, if you had to explain to people, I want you to take those three or four points out of this report, what would you tell them?
So the report makes a very strong watertight case that Israel is imposing a system of oppression and domination that amounts to apartheid and perpetrates the crime against humanity of apartheid against Palestinians in all areas under the control of Israel, meaning Israel and occupied Palestinian territories, and with direct effect on Palestinian refugees outside of this territory, particularly in preventing them the right to return to their homes. The system that is imposed, the system of apartheid, is made up of basically four main pillars. The first is fragmentation, fragmenting Palestinians into different groups, different geographies, not allowing them to connect and be just one collective. Two, segregation and control. It is when Palestinians are pushed into enclaves and controlled within these enclaves and in between the enclaves, particularly controlling the right to freedom of movement, for example. It's dispossessing of land and property. It's the land regime that Israel has put in place to take property, particularly land, in a racist way from Palestinians and not allowing them also in a discriminatory manner access to that land. And four, it's the deprivation of rights, particularly social and economic rights. So what the report does is it relays on more than 20 years of Amnesty's documentation of patterns of violations by Israel against the Palestinians. And it does also new documentation within the context of writing this report, which took 4 years, going back to some of the cases, case studies, including individuals and communities, which Amnesty has documented violations against and campaigned on or for many years, including, for example, Homs and Hididiya, north of the Jordan Valley, if you want, which are kind of semi-nomadic hamlets that Israel is continuously targeting them with dispossession of property and demolition of their homes and harassment by the army, including, for example, carrying out military exercises in where these communities live. So Amnesty has documented the violations against these communities for now, I think it's more than 15 years, continuously, and campaign for the protection of rights of Homs and Hididiya, and are right now, for example, in this report as a case study. And we also kind of carried out documentation of the recent violations that they've had to endure during the course of writing this report. So it's extensive documentation, relaying both on what we've done before and fresh documentation, plus legal analysis of this documentation in the framework of international law, particularly the crime of apartheid, and how these violations connect with each other. So what the report also presents makes the case in relation to the crime against humanity is it says, this is the system in place, and to maintain this system, Israel perpetrates crimes including forcible transfer, arbitrary detention and torture, unlawful killings, and the deprivation of basic rights or persecution against the Palestinians in order to maintain this system of oppression and domination. So, therefore, apartheid in the report is both a system and a crime at the same time. They're there with an intent that is very clear. It's clear in the laws, policies, and practices, but also in the statements of Israeli officials from the creation of the state until today, which basically says that Israel intends to maintain Jewish-Israeli hegemony in terms of demography and geography in lands under its control. So basically, always maintaining more Jewish Israelis than Palestinians in these areas, and maximum control over land in this area, whether it is Israel or the occupied Palestinian territories. An important note to clarify, while we do find that apartheid as a system, as a crime, exists today in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, in order to understand it, and this is what took us a lot of time, and there's, you know, extensive analysis of this, you need to look at the root causes of what we have today. And in studying the root causes and carrying out, you know, study of laws, policies, and practices, it takes us back to 1948, the establishment of the state of Israel as a Jewish state and democratic, it says in its declaration. And then the military rule that it imposed on Palestinians who, yes, were given citizenship, but were maintained as second class, if not, you know, third and fourth class citizens, and under an arbitrary military rule that is imposed only on them and no one else, only the Palestinians and no one else under what has become Israel. And then the land regime, the laws that were put in place to basically confiscate Palestinian private property, particularly to mention here the absentee property law, which is the law that was passed in 1952 to allow the state to take the properties of the refugees, Palestinians who were forcibly displaced during the Nakba or ethnic cleansing around the time of the establishment of the state, and to move these properties into the control of the state, including those who remained there. For example, the report presents the case of Iqrith, which is a village in the north that Israel has forcibly transferred its population to nearby. They never left the area. They never left what became Israel. They remained few kilometers away, but until now are unable to return to their village or to reclaim back their lands. So you see how, you know, in looking at the situation now, you need to go back to what happened then to fully understand the extent of this system and the effects of this crime on Palestinians, both as citizens of Israel and as residents in the occupied Palestinian territories and as refugees outside.
Thanks, Ali. You know what's interesting, I guess, you know, when you think about the response to this report, a lot of people, plenty of people have welcomed it, obviously the Palestinians first. And obviously you got attacked by Israeli officials, by supporters of Israel all around the world, including in the US. But what's interesting, and I think Chris McGrail in The Guardian wrote about this in yesterday, is that if you listen to the declarations of Israeli officials, you know, from 48 until now, if you read some of the laws, you know, of Israel, if, you know, Israel doesn't have a constitution, but, you know, the basic laws are, in a way, a constitution, there is a word in Hebrew called afchada. Afchada in Hebrew means separation. Separation means apartheid. So why is it that if you look at the facts, many Israeli officials support have called it the way it was, apartheid, for many years. But now that Amnesty has published this report, everyone is coming against Amnesty as being anti-Semitic and the rest.
In my view, it's the way that it was used before. It's as if a warning, right? That if, you know, a course is not corrected, Israel will become an apartheid. If annexation of what remains of the West Bank is seen through, it will become apartheid. If this, then apartheid, you know? So this is always something to kind of, I would say, use as a term politically, you know, for certain political agendas and towards sometimes, you know, to seriously warn perhaps about what may become. Now, what Amnesty is saying is that it's not going to become apartheid. It is apartheid here and now. And here is a strong case based on professional scientific documentation of patterns of human rights violations and a legal, you know, in-depth legal analysis of laws, policies and practices, and also statements by Israeli officials that show how Israel has already established a system of oppression and domination over Palestinians, amounting to apartheid, and perpetrated the crime of apartheid against Palestinians, both inside of Israel and in the OPT, right? And now, I guess, this is the challenge. What Amnesty will be working on is to ensure that there is a recognition of the situation as it is. You know, we're not new in here. We're, you know, joining the Palestinian organizations, intellectuals and academics who have pioneered this work. They are the first who were using the language, using apartheid as a legal framework to help better understand the situation for what it is, and called for organizations, including Amnesty, to do its own work vis-a-vis apartheid. And then Israeli organizations and Human Rights Watch last year put out their report making the case that Israel is perpetrating the crime of apartheid against Palestinians. And so now Amnesty. And what we hope to do by joining is to increase this momentum that is led by civil society organizations at this point to ensure that there's more recognition on four fronts, right? The first is the general public, let's call it, which includes media, academics, journalists, and others. The second is third states, those with responsibility, legal responsibility, and moral responsibility towards the rights of people who are under system of oppression and domination amounting to apartheid. Third is international organizations, international and regional organizations, so that is the UN, the EU, African Union, and others. And fourth is businesses. So our approach right now is to ensure that this recognition is solid, it's widespread, And it is a beginning of then action. So these third states to act according to their legal obligations, the members of civil society, general public, the media, to also act on this recognition, to always ensure that the narrative, the way they understand, the way they speak about the situation in Israel-Palestine, ensures that, you know, there's an understanding and the using of apartheid as a legal framework, and also seeing how that apartheid being one of the more extreme forms of violent racism also intersects then with struggles that are right now at the forefront of, you know, situations all around the world, whether it is, you know, in the US with Black Lives Matter, or in Europe with Black Lives Matter, or, you know, indigenous movement population, you know, indigenous population movements in, you know, settler colonies such as Australia, the United States and Canada. So this intersectionality is really important for businesses to ensure that they do not do business in a way that contributes to then the system of apartheid or the perpetrating of the crime of apartheid. And of course, you know, coming to the international organizations, the UN, one, if it's at the level of the Human Rights Council, to ensure that the Commission of Inquiry that was set up last year by the Human Rights Council to investigate apartheid in Israel and Palestine, and it has the mandate to do so. The ICC, the International Criminal Court, to include an investigation, apartheid into the ongoing investigation by the Office of the Prosecutor. And also, you know, the EU and the African Union to ensure that then their relationship with Israel does not contribute to human rights violations and the system of apartheid that Israel is imposing. So we're working towards from recognition to action, and then from action to accountability. And what accountability looks like is the dismantling of a system. There's no reform. You know, you cannot reform apartheid. You can only, any person who cares for freedom, equality, justice, can only imagine a world without apartheid. You know, that apartheid does not exist. There's no way of making it better. And I think this is what's so important here, that there is a situation that nobody can live with. There's no way of making it normal. It is not normal. It's a moral and legal duty to take, you know, action against it, and we must do so immediately.
I wanted to ask you, I want to go back to what can we do now and actions. But first, I wanted to actually ask you about something very important that actually a lot of people that are not familiar with Palestine and Israel don't really understand. We've had these discussions in the sort of the solidarity movement with academics, with legal experts for 15 years or 20 years now. I remember at least 10, 12 years ago, John Dugard, who are the UN special reporters to the occupied territories, issued a report on apartheid, but it focused only on the West Bank. I was, as you know, I was part of the Russell Tribunal in Palestine. We had this session in Cape Town in 2011 on apartheid. And there was this huge debate on, are we talking apartheid in the West Bank, or are we talking apartheid against the Palestinian people with an S, to Palestinians? You came out, and the report came out, with Palestinians with a big S at the end, which means Palestinians in the occupied territory, the West Bank, Gaza. It also means Palestinian citizens of Israel. It also means Palestinian refugees. So this is huge. Why, in your opinion, was it important for you to make this clear distinction? But also, I wanted to ask you, and that's sort of a side question, try, because it's not easy, to explain to people the difference between citizenship in Israel itself versus nationality, because people don't understand that. They don't understand the difference when it applies to Israel. So there's like two questions. Thanks, man.
So on the first, look, when it comes to the visuals of apartheid, it is indeed very much clearer when it comes to the occupied Palestinian territories than it is, you know, we're looking at Palestinian citizens of Israel. Although, you know, I will argue, this is what we kind of continuously, what I would argue, you know, the situation in the Naqab for Bedouin Palestinians there is perhaps for some a lot more oppressive in terms of a reality than for Palestinians living in Ramallah like myself. Although, you know, Ramallah is under military occupation, it is part of the occupied Palestinian territories, it is surrounded by walls and checkpoints, it gets, you know, raided by the army very frequently to carry out arrests in the middle of the night. There are unlawful killings that take place on also a very frequent basis. But if you look at, for example, Ras Jraba, one of the unrecognized villages in the Naqab Negev desert, these people have been living there for, you know, what they say, centuries, right? For a very, very, very long time. They have their ways of life, which is a mix between, you know, agriculture and herding. And are right now basically segregated into this one place, and they're under threat of demolition of their homes. They're not given any basic services like their fellow Jewish citizens who live very close by in Dimona, for example, a city that is being expanded in the south. No electricity, no water, no access to education, no clinics. And even as citizens, they, yes, have the right to vote in municipal and parliamentary elections, but are not provided that infrastructure to do so. So one can argue that they are actually also prevented from the right to political participation that is granted to them as citizens. How so? They don't have any place to go and vote when there are, for example, parliamentary elections. They would need to be taken by buses, and they need to have special registration to be able to do so. And so it just complicates it so that you are not able to carry out this right of political participation. Similar with the municipal election. So, this is a reality that, you know, you look at then the body of laws, policies, and practices, and you see that it affects Palestinians across, you know, or on either side of the green line. And so, in order to fully understand the effects of a system and a crime of apartheid against Palestinians, you need to look at it. And this is at the core of the definition of apartheid. It's the domination of one group over another. And one group here is the Jewish Israelis, and the other are Palestinians. So it is an approach of looking at people rather than at geography. You know, it's not looking at Israel versus the occupied Palestinian territories versus the diaspora. It is to see how these people as a whole, and yes, they may live different oppressive realities, how they are equally victims of the system and crime of apartheid, right? And this was the approach for us. And this is why it took a long time, because, again, the violence of the reality in the OPT may be more visible than the violence of the reality for Palestinian citizens inside of Israel. But, and here, you know, I'm paraphrasing something by, you know, that our Secretary General Ines Kalamar said, that what shocked her the most was not that violence that you could see on Qalandia, in the wall, in the military checkpoints, or the difference between a Jewish Israeli settlement and a Palestinian community, but rather it's the banality of apartheid, how it has been so entrenched, whether it is in the bureaucracy of having families separated, or being able to, you know, protect your residency in East Jerusalem, or to be able to travel, for example, as a couple or whatever through the airport, or, you know, someone needs to go to join. It's the banality of apartheid that was perhaps the most shocking for her. And it is that. In order to understand it, we need to understand that Palestinian citizens of Israel were put under a system of oppression and domination from the establishment of the state in 1948, with the imposition of the military rule, which lasted from 48 until 66, the land regime that confiscated their lands and dispossessed them of their property, and the violations of their civil and political rights then within that period, that was never dismantled. There was never a change to that system of oppression and domination. It remained in place. And it is right now the system of apartheid that amounts to a crime against humanity that they're also under. And so you need to understand it fully and in depth in order to tackle it in a meaningful and strategic way. Otherwise, will just be basically doing the same as we did before, is trying to address the symptoms of this system rather than going to the root causes, which Palestinians, and especially over the last year or so, have been calling for, with the solidarity protests with the Sheikh Jarrah, and how that turned into an emblematic case, and then the general strike where Palestinians across the geography have observed, not going to work, not going to the schools, and saying, we are one. We're fighting against fragmentation, and we are one under this system of oppression and domination. It must stop. And so, in order to understand that and be able to respond to this Palestinian call meaningfully, you need to see the situation in a way we call holistically, right? And not divided up geographically.
And the second part of the question was different between citizenship and nationality, because like I'm a French national. How does it apply to Israel, for example?
Yeah, yes, we had this conversation also with Ines, because she is French, and she said, this for a French person, this is completely absurd.
I mean, that's why like people don't get it. I mean, and in a way for me, explaining this difference explains it all. You don't even have to go much further to explain. I mean, apartheid comes from basic understanding of citizenship and nationality. So go ahead.
Right. So this goes back to some of the major laws that have a constitutional value. Israel does not have a constitution, but it has a body of basic laws that make up for and have a constitutional value. So one of them is the law of return, for example, which allows any Jew from around the world to migrate to Israel and gain citizenship automatically on arrival. There is also the nationality law, and most recently in 2018, the nation state law. And in Israeli law, there's the difference between a national and a citizen. So every national is a citizen, but not every citizen is a national. And nationals are only Jews. Palestinians are, some of them are citizens, but they are never, unless they become Jewish, can become also national and enjoy then the full body of rights, including what? For example, the nation state law in 2018, which was a law that came to kind of crown the body of discriminatory law, says that only, Israel is a state for Jewish people. Only and only the Jewish people have the right to self-determination in Israel. So here is where you could see this difference, very much embodied in law. And of course, once law, also in practice. What does self-determination also mean? It means also the enhancement as part of the law, enhancement of Jewish settlement across the land that Israel controls, meaning Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. So not also the enhancement of settlement, meaning, the development of communities and being able to support the communities so that they flourish. That these rights as enshrined in law are only to the nationals who are only Jewish Israelis and not Palestinians who are only citizen and are unable to enjoy, for example, right to self-determination in the state.
Finally, I wanted to go back, that would be my final question, about the actions. And, now we've got this amazing report. We've got the Human Rights Watch report. We've got this B'Tselem report. We've got all the, info from Palestinian organization like, Al-Haq and I forgot the names. But anyway, many, many of them that we've worked with in the past. You were talking about actions, clear actions towards states, towards third parties, towards corporations. And that's obviously very, very important. But, in 2004, the International Court of Justice came with a legal opinion against the wall, and now we call it the apartheid wall or the separation wall. In this report in 2004, it said that the wall is illegal, shouldn't have been constructed and should actually be demolished. And it also said that third parties and states had the obligation to ensure that the wall was going to be demolished. It's now 2022, so nearly 20 years later, the wall is fully built, except I saw that in Al-Ram, the wall fell, right? Nature took over, which was really an amazing sight. But so it's great to say, you know, we're going to call for actions, but the inaction, in a way, of the international community, and by this I mean states, has been incredible when it comes to Israel. In a way, despite reports like the 2004 International Court of Justice report, Israel has been rewarded for, you know, as had like access to European, you know, networks and funds, etc. So how do you intend to actually, with the help of many, this time make a real change? And that'll be sort of my final question. And I know it's not an easy one.
So Amnesty is a campaigning organization, and it's a movement of members. There are 10 million members around the world who will be, or at least a huge part, what we hope a huge part of them will be mobilized to basically push for a campaign that ensures, as I said, kind of recognition at first. So on one hand, what I think is very important to specifically audiences in democracies is to have consistent pressure on parliamentarians, members of the parliament, to continuously, and not only over the next couple of months, but really for the long haul, over the next few years, to continuously raise questions in parliament, make statements in parliament, call their ministers for questioning about then the relationship, perhaps complicity, and their then actions to suppress and punish the crime of apartheid. You know, that there is a legal responsibility here that states must act on. And so we need the pressure from inside, as well as pressure from the outside, right? Meaning that organizations like Amnesty, in partnership with other human rights organizations, will continuously put the pressure on governments through meetings, through questions, through letters, through reports that would also perhaps, you know, uncover their relationship. So to then take on their responsibility according to international law. There is a momentum that we believe has been built over the last year with, you know, people all around the world moving in action and solidarity with the community in Sheikh Jarrah and Palestinians, right? So, and there was a pointing to root causes, right? That we shouldn't just deal with the symptoms, that we need to address the root causes. Otherwise, we're just going to have the same cycle repeat over and over again, which we've seen over the many years. That was recognized by the UN with the establishment of a commission of inquiry that is one evergreen, that is permanent. It does not have a time scope where it stops, which is very important. It also includes Israel and not only the OPT in its investigative mandate. And three, that it can move evidence to the International Criminal Court and that that evidence can be used in an investigation. So it's a very powerful mechanism. Why I mention it is because in its language, in the setup of the Commission of Inquiry, in its reporting, they will be addressing root causes. We hope that they see apartheid as a framework that would allow them to address root causes effectively, and we'll be pushing them to do so. But it is the root causes, and it's a mobilizing then of people from, you know, within democracies, especially those who are influential on the global scene and who have relations, ally relations with Israel, to have the pressure, particularly from civil society and from parliament, that can be matched with pressure from the outside so that it becomes really, really hard for them to continue the unconditional support for Israel without, you know, in this impunity and without account for, you know, what we're saying now. This is a crime against humanity that's being perpetrated. No one can stay silent, and no one can accept that we live in a world where this is taking place without anybody saying anything about it, at least, let alone, you know, take action against it. So let us recognize it for what it is, and let us then take, you know, concrete action against it towards the dismantling of the system. So to your audiences, I would recommend, alongside the report, we've put out an online education, human rights education course. It's 90 minutes. It's available in a number of languages: English, French, Spanish, Hebrew, and Arabic. Hopefully also we can translate it to other languages. It looks at, you know, what apartheid is under international law. It looks at apartheid in history with a comparative view of Israel, Palestine, South Africa, and Myanmar, which is another situation which Amnesty made a determination that there is a situation of apartheid there against the Rohingya Muslims. And the third part is about the experience of Palestinians under Israel's apartheid. So we hope that this tool would allow wider audiences to be able to access and understand the framework, this legal framework, and be able then to use that in pressuring their representatives in parliament not to let this go and to keep the pressure on their governments until something happens, something cracks. And this is what we're hoping for.
Shukran kathir, Saleh.
Alan Frank.
Thanks for taking the time to explain all this. I will obviously post the links of the report, the course, in the description of the video. So, again,
really appreciate you. Thank you for reaching out, and I'm really glad we reconnected. We should keep it up.
Welcome to the Mondo Weiss Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Reed. At Mondo Weiss, we cover the movements, activists, and policymakers who affect the struggle for freedom in Palestine. The Trump administration's Abraham Accords were championed as historic peace agreements, despite the fact they actually normalized relations between authoritarian regimes and facilitated massive weapons deals. Mondo Weiss's U.S. correspondent, Michael Aria, spoke with Beth Miller, Senior Government Affairs Manager at Jewish Voice for Peace Action, about the impact of the agreements and recent congressional efforts to enhance them.
Okay, so to start, I was wondering if you could just explain what the Abraham Accords are and what impact they've had on the region thus far.
Absolutely. So the so-called Abraham Accords are essentially a Trump administration era policy of pursuing weapons deals and business deals with authoritarian regimes in exchange for them normalizing relations with Israel, which really means undermining and sidelining Palestinian rights. So the Abraham Accords led to the normalizing of relationships between the Israeli government, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan, as of now. And in each of those cases, what we saw were the Trump administration, with the support of Jared Kushner at the time, pushing for very dangerous weapon sales and kind of political trading to try to get those countries to basically say, we don't care about Palestinian rights anymore, we will work publicly with the Israeli government. And so, for example, the United Arab Emirates, in exchange for this kind of, in exchange for normalizing relations with Israel, got the United States to agree to selling F-35s to them. and Reaper drones and other sorts of dangerous weaponry. And, you know, Morocco, in exchange, got the United States government to officially recognize its illegal occupation and annexation of the Western Sahara. So what we're seeing are essentially this approach, it's an approach to foreign policy where the US government is ignoring completely all human rights violations, the occupation, Israel's apartheid government, everything that the Israeli government is doing and its oppression, ongoing violent oppression of Palestinian people, being entirely disregarded. And instead, the US government is saying what quote unquote peace in the Middle East looks like is just to get authoritarian governments trading with one another. So we're seeing the weapon sales I just mentioned, the political trade-offs I just mentioned. A few days ago, a New York Times article came out that revealed through investigations that there was also the sale of Pegasus, which is a spyware technology from the Israeli NSO group tech company, was sold and shared as an incentive as part of these Abraham Accords as well. So that's what the intent of these deals are, right? It's a regressive foreign policy approach that makes everyday people less safe by flooding the region with more weapons and making it easier for authoritarian regimes to deal between surveillance tech and weapons deals and more with one another, while completely ignoring the Palestinian struggle for human rights, justice, and equality, and undermining the safety of everyone in the region.
Democrats criticized the Trump administration's foreign policy when it came to so many issues, but this is one where they've kind of quietly supported it. I think it's been a little underreported how much, you know, widespread support there's been for these arms deals among the Democratic Party. Can you talk about the support that these deals have in Washington? And connected to that, if you could just also talk about how the Biden administration fits into this. What has their role been in these deals since they've taken power?
So unfortunately, but perhaps not surprisingly, Democrats, especially moderate and centrist Democrats, and I include the Biden administration in that, have been very supportive of this approach to foreign policy. Essentially, a lot of them have said to the effect something like, I don't support with anything the Trump administration did, but this was one good thing he did, which really highlights what we all know to be true, which is that the US government, whoever is in control, tends to single out the Israeli government for special treatment, right? So you have Democrats who may talk a big game about centering human rights, putting that back in our foreign policy. But when it comes down to it, it's curious to think then about why they would support this framework of approach to countries in the Middle East that completely sidelines human rights and instead just finds ways to get more weapons and more surveillance tech in the hands of authoritarian and bad actor countries, including the Israeli government. And so what we should be seeing from Democrats, what we should be seeing from all aspects of the US government, but certainly we expect to see it from Democrats, is a foreign policy that actually addresses the needs of everyday people and that centers human rights and equality and justice for all people. And instead, we're seeing Democrats that are supporting and pursuing a foreign policy that basically lines the pockets of Boeing and Raytheon and Lockheed Martin. And so it's very concerning to see. And in fact, there is a bill in Congress right now, the Israel Relations Normalization Act, which we can talk a bit more in a bit more detail about as well, that currently has overwhelming bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate that would effectively endorse this approach, the quote unquote Abraham Accords approach, and praise them. And the Biden administration has very much been part of this and has also stated many times that it supports these deals between countries being made. Basically, what we're seeing here are Democrats who are buying into and actively perpetuating this lie that simply by getting countries to talk and deal with the Israeli government, we are making people somehow safer and more secure. That is not the case. At the core of the problem here is that the Israeli government is carrying out ethnic cleansing against Palestinian people. We're seeing it worsen every single day. There are home demolitions, violent forced displacements, Palestinians across from, you know, across all of Palestine right now, that are worsening every single year. These deals have done nothing to better the situation on the ground for Palestinians. The core of the issue here is ethnic cleansing and apartheid and oppression being carried out by the Israeli government. And instead of addressing that, Democrats and Republicans who support this approach are basically saying, Israel doesn't need to do anything about that. Let's just give them everything they want and get more countries talking to them. And somehow that will make everything better. That really only centers and helps authoritarian regimes and weapons manufacturers, and it makes everyone else less safe.
I wanted to talk about the bill that you just mentioned, the Israel Relations Normalization Act. Exactly what would this legislation do? How is it designed to enhance the Abraham Accords or further them, I guess? And connected to that, JVP Action and other grassroots groups have started an effort to stop it from being passed and raise awareness about it. Can you talk about that effort as well?
So the Israel Relations Normalization Act is a bill that is in both the House and the Senate right now. In the House, I believe it has something like 327 co-sponsors, which is a massive number of co-sponsors. It also has many co-sponsors in the Senate. As I mentioned before, that's bipartisan support, which is incredibly disappointing, though again, not surprising to see US Congress acting in a way that completely not only disregards Palestinian rights, but is complicit in the total undermining and sidelining of any attempts at furthering the cause for Palestinian rights and justice. The bill is essentially a full-throated endorsement of the Abraham Accords. It refers to all these deals I just mentioned as being a great approach that has done, that have done great things, that have made the region more secure, and that it should be the policy of the US government to continue to pursue those kinds of deals with more governments, to get more governments to make these kinds of deals with Israel and start talking more to Israel. There is no mention of the occupation. There's no mention of Palestinian rights. The thing that could be spun as being remotely close to that is a mention of the two-state solution as being needed, which, as we all know very well, does not mean anything close to support for Palestinian rights, right? It's a political talking point at this point, and really means nothing except for it was probably just thrown in there to try to get some Democrats who are slightly to the left of AIPAC, perhaps, right? That's what that was thrown in there for. So again, it is a bill that basically says the way we think the US government should approach pursuing, quote, peace in the Middle East is by trying to find ways to get more and more governments to deal publicly with the Israeli apartheid government. That's what is at the core of this bill. And, you know, the listeners to this show will know very well and have known for a long time that Israel is a violent apartheid regime, right? Palestinians have been saying it for decades. Over the last couple of years, Israeli human rights organizations have begun saying it, Human Rights Watch, and now as of today, Amnesty International has just said it as well. This is a bill that is basically saying, how do we get more governments to interact with our favorite government, which is an apartheid regime? What we should be doing is taking back steps, right? Away from the Israeli government. We should be taking moves to sanction it, arms embargo, cutting and withholding military funding, and doing everything we can to force and pressure the Israeli government to end its apartheid regime, to stop ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And instead, we are doing the exact opposite. And the Israel Relations Normalization Act is actively pursuing a policy to support the Israeli government, to give it everything it wants without it having to take even a tiny step toward ending its violation of Palestinian human rights. It's worth noting also that this goes alongside other efforts we're seeing in Congress in support of the Abraham Accords. So there are also caucuses in the House and the Senate that are basically caucuses that are explicitly created to support and pursue more deals like this. Again, I cannot emphasize enough that by deals, what that means is weapon sales, political horse trading, and the sale of dangerous surveillance tech to bad actor governments, including the Israeli government. That's what this is pushing for, and that's what our government seems to want to prioritize. JVP Action partnered with dozens of other organizations to release a statement stating opposition from progressive grassroots and advocacy organizations to this approach. And the statement essentially calls on Congress to embrace a foreign policy that centers the human rights of actual people and actually centers a policy, and is a policy that actually centers making everyday people live safer lives instead of the Abraham Accords and the Israel Relations Normalization Act, which seek to line the pockets of weapons manufacturers and help authoritarian governments deal with each other more smoothly and effectively and trade with each other with more ease. So this statement we sent around to offices across the Hill. We're pushing it out in media and online, and it is just the first step. We're working also closely with partner organizations on initiatives to flood Congress with phone calls and emails to try to get as many reps as possible and as many senators as possible to not support this bill. We don't know exactly when the Israel Relations Normalization Act will come for a vote, but it's possible it could come for a vote in the House quite soon. And so it's actually really critical that everyone reach out to their member of Congress, because you might have a member of Congress who you would assume is not supporting this bill, but who is currently a co-sponsor of it, because there is a ton of political pressure for people to get on this bill because it is being spun misleadingly as a bill that's all about peace in the Middle East. As I've said, that is not what this bill is about. This is a bill about weapons deals between authoritarian governments and supporting Israel's apartheid regime and refusing to do anything to hold the Israeli government accountable. But because of how it's being spun, it has an overwhelming popularity. So it is going to take overwhelming grassroots support to pull as get as many progressives in particular to say no to this bill and to say, this is not how the United States government should be acting. This is not the way that we should be centering our foreign policy. And so that's the kind of thing that we're pushing for right now in the lead up to a possible vote in the near future.
And finally, I wanted to follow up on something you just mentioned. When these efforts are touted by Republicans or Democrats, Palestine and Palestinians are often not mentioned at all. Can you talk about how these deals have sidelined Palestinian rights? And what kind of policies should groups be advocating for in contrast to deals like the Abraham Accords?
It's one of the most telling and revealing things about these words that Palestinians are so rarely mentioned, right? Like you said, Palestinians, Palestinian rights, the occupation, apartheid, none of it really comes up when proponents of these deals are talking about them. And if they do, it is lip service at best and kind of in passing. It is essentially a green light to the Israeli government to continue what it's doing, right? At the core of, you know, leading up to these deals, the core idea here was that other countries in the region would not trade with, would not engage with the Israeli government until the Israeli government ended its violation of Palestinian rights, ended the occupation, et cetera, et cetera. And now that is all breaking down and Palestinians are being thrown under the bus. And so not only from these other governments that are now, you know, many of them were already dealing with Israel in many ways under the table, right? We know that, but it's now being publicized and officialized in this new way. But also the US government, by the US government doing what it has always done, claiming to be a neutral mediator when in fact acting as Israel's, you know, biggest proponent and advocate in the region. All of us, all of the U.S. government and all these other governments are effectively saying to the Israeli government, you're fine. Keep doing what you're doing. We just don't care. We are going to deal with you. We are going to work. And as the U.S. government, we're saying we are going to work really hard to get you everything you want. And you don't have to do anything for us to do that. You don't have to end the occupation. You don't have to end discrimination of Palestinians. You don't have to lift the illegal blockade of Palestinians living in Gaza, which is collective punishment of 2 million people. You don't have to stop ethnic cleansing. You don't have to end home demolitions. You don't have to do anything. Keep it up. It's all good. we'll do all this for you too. And so it has, you know, it's sidelining Palestinian rights. It is completely undermining the movement for Palestinian freedom, Palestinian rights, and Palestinian liberation, and trying to isolate Palestinians to the point where they are forced to give up on their political and human rights. That's the end goal, right? Is to isolate Palestinians so much that they don't have any power, any leverage. And so again, where we find ourselves is in a position where it's up to people, it's up to the movement, the Palestinian rights movement, it's up to allies of the Palestinian rights movement to stand up and fight back against this, because of course, again, no surprise, governments are not going to do it for us. The Biden administration is not going to do this. The Biden administration has made it very clear that they do not care about Palestinian rights, and they will not be taking bold action for Palestinians. And this is just another example of that. And so it's up to the grassroots to push back and fight back against that. And in terms of what that has to look like, I think we can turn to and look to what Palestinians have been saying for as long, you know, since 1948, and then since 1967, right? And we know what the answer is here. There is apartheid, there is an occupation, there is ethnic cleansing. And for there to be a just future, those things have to be addressed. The Israeli government has to be held accountable. And those things have to end. And so that's the only way to move forward here. That is the sticking point in moving forward, is that Palestinians are living under a brutal, violent apartheid regime. And there is no way for us to move forward toward a just peace without holding the Israeli government and actors who are complicit in and supporting that accountable and ending it. That's how we can continue to move forward. And that's really the only way to begin doing that. And for the US government, that means ending the $3.8 billion we send in support every year, ending the unquestioning diplomatic cover we give to the Israeli government in the international community, at the United Nations, et cetera, and starting there to move forward.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today. It's been very informative.
Thanks so much, Michael, for talking with me.
Thanks for listening to our show, a production of MondoWeiss.net. The music is from Sound of Picture. Visit our site to sign up for free daily and weekly newsletters on Palestine, Israel, and related U.S. politics.
So that's it for us for today. You're listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Tree Canada's National Greening Program, native tree seedlings are planted across Canada, creating a widespread impact. Planted trees provide habitat, prevent soil erosion, and reforest areas that have suffered tree loss due to pests and weather. Tree Canada performs 1, 2, and 5-year assessments to monitor tree survival and ensure the trees planted are on track to meet the forest cover goals of the site. To learn more or to get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Confidence, optimism, humor, and love. Not to mention a dose of determination, endurance, empathy, motivation, hope, and ingenuity.
But above all, it takes a second dose of vaccine.
A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Yeah. Yeah. Fashion shows, fancy clothes. Fancy. That's just the way it goes.